Our next public hearing is subdivision 2007-9 Thompson Shell LLC.
This is an application to consider the subdivision of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district in Broadkill 100, Sussex County, dividing 196.2 acres into 256 lots, using the cluster development concept and located south of Route 16, 2,500 feet east of Route 1. This application, the applicants have resubmitted revised site plans and also a file-bound exhibit booklet making reference to this application. And I believe Mr. Abbott can provide us with any additional comments based on the Technical Advisory Committee review of this application.
Mr. Wheatley, the TAC review report of July 18, 2007 will be made a part of the record, and we've not received any additional correspondence.
All right, sir, we thank you. Chair recognizes Mr. Fuquay.
Good evening, gentlemen. For the record, my name is Jim Fuquay. I'm an attorney here in Georgetown, and I represent the applicant, Thompson Shell LLC. With me tonight is Lincoln Davis, who is a representative of the developer. Preston Shell will be walking in during my presentation, who's one of the owners, and also Matt Peterson and David Kuklish of Element, who are the designers of the site. As Mr. Lank stated, there was an exhibit book submitted containing site information and studies that were done in connection with the application. This is an application for a 256 single-family lot subdivision to be known as Woodland Preserve, and it is designed utilizing the cluster provisions of the zoning ordinance. The property contains 195.6 acres. It's located on the south side of Broadkill Road, which is County Road 16. It's approximately 2,500 feet east of the Route 16, Route 1 intersection, and the site is just east of the Rookery Golf Course. The development will be served by a central water system for domestic use and fire protection that will be provided by Tidewater Utilities. As you know, a public regulated water company, Tidewater currently holds a certificate of public convenience and necessity for this area. The development also will be served by a regional community wastewater system that will be operated by Artesian Wastewater Management, again, a public regulated utility company. The wastewater from this development would be transmitted to the Elizabethtown Wastewater Facility, which has been approved. The wastewater there would be treated and disposed of. A preliminary site plan for the Elizabethtown treatment plant was approved in January of this year. At the time that that was presented to you and to the county council, it was stated that that plant was planned and designed and with sufficient capacity to serve a substantial volume of users beyond the boundaries of the Elizabethtown development, and again, one of which we hope will be the Woodland Preserve. A wetland delineation of the site was performed by Envirotech Environmental Consulting, Inc. A copy of that is in the exhibit book. There are three areas of wetlands located on the site. In the northeast corner is an 8.6-acre area of forested federal wetlands. Toward the center of the site is an existing pond and outfall ditch containing 1.25 acres of federal wetlands. And at the southern end of the site is a 29-acre area of tidal wetlands associated with the Broadkill River. All of the wetland areas will remain undisturbed, and there will be a minimum buffer of 50 feet provided adjacent to the tidal wetlands as well as the federal wetlands. And the wetland areas will be designated and marked. The site is near the Prime Hook Wildlife Area, which is located on the other side of Route 16. That is the home of the elusive Delmarva fox squirrel. Enclosed in the exhibit book is a letter dated July 18, 2008, from the United States Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife Service, indicating that they had reviewed the plans and project information for the proposed development, and the service concluded that the proposed development is not likely to adversely affect the Delmarva fox squirrel. And the reason for that conclusion from the Wildlife Service is that only 0.2 of an acre of habitat is actually being cleared, and approximately 3 acres of habitat is being affected. However, above and beyond that, 9.18 acres of land along the east boundary of the site is being afforested, so that'll be creating new and additional forest areas, which is the fox squirrel habitat. A phase one environmental site assessment was also performed by EnviroTech. That study concluded that there was no evidence of any environmental conditions on the site that would affect the proposed residential use, and that no further studies were recommended. Again, there is a copy of that in the exhibit book. A traffic impact study dated January 9, 2007 was prepared by Orth Rogers and Associates, and that was based on a scope of work meeting defining the work to be reviewed by DelDOT. The traffic impact study was reviewed on DelDOT's behalf by McCormick Taylor, which, as you know, are traffic engineers that are doing review work for DelDOT. That review recommended certain roadway improvements on Route 16, some intersection improvements at Route 1 and Route 16, and a multi-use path improvements along Route 16. And again, that letter is in the exhibit book. Subsequent to that, Orth Rogers did submit additional analysis to DelDOT in August of this year, indicating that, in its opinion, based on some change of facts, some of the Route 16, Route 1 intersection improvements were not warranted based on their traffic analysis. The main reason for that was there was a revision of a proposed development that was going to be located on the west side of Route 1, and that resulted in less impact on that intersection. And, of course, that will be up to DelDOT to determine whether or not there would be a change in the scope of work that they would require. In summary, our development will complete whatever road improvements are ultimately required by DelDOT based on their analysis, and that would be a condition of your approval. As to the social impact of the development, the site is in the Cape Henlopen School District. It's in the fire service area of the Milton Fire Department, and the site is located approximately 2 miles east of the town of Milton, where shopping and services are available. The development will have a homeowners association that will be responsible for the enforcement of the restrictions and maintenance of the recreation areas and the community open space areas, and that will be done through collection of required assessments from all lot owners. There will be 2 recreational amenity areas located on the site. The main recreational area will contain about 1.5 acres. It will have a parking lot for the recreation facilities. There'll be a community building with restrooms, a swimming pool, 2 multi-use sports courts, which, as you know, are a combination tennis court, basketball court, and a playground area. Also, there's an area referred to as the Village Green, which will be a large area of maintained open space, basically that can be used for play. At the south end of the site, the end down toward where the tidal wetlands are, there's a passive recreational area that will also have a parking lot, it'll have a playground, and it'll have picnic facilities. In addition to the on-site recreational amenities that I mentioned, freshwater fishing is available nearby at the ponds at Prime Hook. And as I mentioned before, there is a public golf course and practice facilities located adjacent to the site, which is the Rookery Golf Course. The site is zoned AR1, which allows single-family lots as a permitted use. Under the Sussex County Land Use Plan, the site is designated as being in the low-density area. As I mentioned, the cluster provisions of the zoning ordinance were utilized. In the low-density area, the ordinance permits 1.5 lots per acre. The proposed 256 lots on the 195-acre parcel is a gross density of approximately 1.31 lots per acre. As we'll explain, by using the cluster provisions of the ordinance and based on the shape and the characteristics of the site, the lots were able to be designed and situated so that each of the 256 lot each of the 256 lots border some type of community open space. The total open space on the site, and this would be including the stormwater areas and the wetland areas, as well as the community use areas, is approximately 121 acres, or 62% of the site. And if the stormwater areas and the wetland areas were excluded from the open space, that would still result in a total of 74 acres, or approximately 38% of the site. So it is in excess of what is required. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Matt to review the site plan with you and basically show you the design of the development.
Hi, my name is Matthew Peterson. I'm a principal at Element Design Group, and we were the land planner and the civil engineer on the job. Do you guys mind if I stand over there and talk real loud?
Don't mind at all.
Great. Thank you. As Mr. Fukui discussed, we approached this site layout by establishing sort of a base map of all the existing features, of which there are quite a few on this property. Obviously, our main access road is on Broadkill Road, Route 16. We have a large existing stand of trees in this area.
I'm going to ask you to stand on the other side so these folks behind you can see.
Absolutely.
There
Sorry
you go.
That.
Thank you.
Additionally, we have the Rookery Golf Course is in this area down here. Again, we have some wooded areas through here, some on our parcel, some not. Getting back towards the back here, obviously a marsh area here leading all the way back to the Broadkill River. So we have an existing pond on the site. That kind of completed the existing features of this. In doing so, we sort of put our entrance onto Route 16. The one plan adjustment that we made, obviously, we shifted that in the westerly direction for the plus signs to avoid headlight flash on an adjacent property. So that is a little difference there for the plan. From there, we laid out a series of roads that allowed for both the maximization of open space and backing onto open space for each lot, but also created a street network that would allow for more curved roads to slow some traffic down and also to create some visual streetscapes as we drove through here, creating more of a rural effect rather than more of a gridded area. In doing so, we came up with a couple different ideas of open space and how that sort of worked. We do represent a couple different kinds of meet open space. Some lots actually front and back onto open space. Some back onto the wooded area. In these areas, afforested or created new forest land in our buffers here. So those lots too will back up to that. Some of them back up to stormwater ponds, the existing ponds, and then in other areas. We pointed everybody onto where our active community gathering space is. We're proposing to do street trees and street lights on all the road network. Additionally, sidewalks on one side of the road to keep our impervious down, and then enhancing that with the trail system that will work through all the greenways through there. Thus allowing everyone to walk through all of our amenities and kind of experience all the different levels of open space. With that, I'm going to switch boards here real quick. We have an open space diagram. Kind of break that down a little bit more. So with our open space, as we discussed, 61% of our site being open space. When you take out the stormwater management, some of the wetland stuff, you end up with 38% open space. So again, those spaces are delineated by this existing stand of trees up here. This is the subsequent wetlands in that area. We have our existing pond here, and the tidal outfall, the outfall attached to that. The afforested area here is shown in this color green. You can kind of see where that sort of wraps around. This creates habitat corridor for various types of animals, and including humans. So we propose a trail in some of these areas as well to experience that. Specifically on stormwater management, because of the Broadkill River and its tidal influence, We can keep our grading down, minimize that by taking advantage of hopefully getting a quantity waiver. We'll still need to address quality, hence the stormwater ponds, but quantity will be most likely waived because of our tidal influence. Specifically, our two main amenity areas of physically built things. We have an active community gathering space in this area here. It's blown up for everyone to see a little better, not that blowing it up two times helps you guys 25 feet away, but we propose there a community building, a bigger tot lot, pool area, and then a sports court, behind which is our village green area, kind of a main gathering area where you can play catch or pick up game of some nature or just have a big community gathering there. Our less active or passive open space back here for community gathering includes, you know, different areas of, you could have a fire pit and a seating area there, grilling area and picnic, and then sort of a smaller tot lot area there. But again, each of those is within walking distance of a majority of the homes. So we think we accomplished that pretty well. I'll review my notes for a second, but I think that that's everything I wanted to discuss. The buffers, as you'll notice, and Mr. Fuqua talked about, required buffers on most of this is 30 feet. We have a requirement at our office to go 50 feet. So the minimal space that you see would be 50 feet, but we're really more in the 70 to 200 feet range as we kind of undulate in and out of these areas. Our lot sizes, I think required is 7,500 square feet. Our average size is about 9,000 square feet, a little bit more. Smallest lot being 7,700 square feet, largest being, I think, 13,000 square feet. Just depends on where it is in the curve table, if you will. Concludes my...
Gentlemen, I did prepare some proposed conditions and proposed findings, which I'll hand to Mr. Lank and ask that he pass those out to you. I will just state that the conditions are similar conditions that you have imposed on other developments.
Thanks, sir.
In conclusion, I'm reviewing this, and I think as you see, the development is designed to meet the requirements of the cluster ordinance, and I think that's fully complied with, but I think what's more important is this design really meets what was the intent and what was envisioned by the cluster ordinance in terms of the access to open space and the ability to have views and uses of the open space throughout the development. In the exhibit book that was submitted, there are the response to the plus comments. Also, there is a statement addressing the Section 99.9C considerations for a subdivision. There is a statement addressing the cluster development design considerations and an open space management plan, which I'll just refer to rather than go into any detail about that, and ask you just to review those as part of our presentation. As I said, I've just handed out the proposed findings and conditions, and that would conclude our formal presentation, and we will attempt to answer any questions you might have.
All right, sir. We thank you. There might be a question or two. We'll find out. We'll start with Mr. Burton.
Just a couple. You mentioned that the DelDOT, which you were going to make improvements along 16 as far as a multimodal path. Is that all the way down the road to past the wetlands?
My understanding, well, it's along our property boundary, I believe. Or Matt, if you can.
So it would go from, okay.
And that would be in the DelDOT right of way, I believe.
Thank you. A quick runner.
The cluster looks great. Did you ever figure out how many lots you could get without a cluster?
I don't think. No, I'm not aware of that. I don't think anyone ever designed it that way.
And go with the buffer again. You mentioned that it was 30 feet.
I think required on most areas in this would be 30 feet. We have a standard in our office is 50 feet, so the minimum buffer on this project is 50 feet.
Now, that buffer, you're talking about a perimeter buffer.
Perimeter buffer and, yes.
And then in addition to that, there is a 50-foot buffer from all wetlands.
That's correct.
There's an additional 50 feet?
But they don't match up on top of one another. The perimeter buffer is just around the exterior of the development. But all wetlands have a 50-foot buffer.
A minimum of 50 feet from the edge of wetlands to a lot would be the minimum. And that, I think, only occurs really in this area here. The wetland lot sits here, so you're probably in the 50 to 60-foot range there as well.
Did I read there was a dock?
It was mentioned in the book, possibly a pier that would go across the wetlands down to the river for view and for access to the river. However, as you know, that would be subject to DENREC permitting. And there's no decision about that. That was going to be something that we just wanted to keep that open for the Homeowners Association if they intended to pursue it, but it's not being proposed at this time.
Okay. And the phasing of the construction of the, both the construction and the amenities that go with the construction?
The way we discussed it would be that this area obviously sets up well for sort of a model home exhibiting area, and then we would probably work back up into this area to get towards this amenity to kind of construct this part of the site first and then work our way back.
As far as the recreational amenities, again, it's been pretty much standard that the commission's required that the amenities be constructed within 2 years of the issuance of the first building permit. What we would envision would be that the recreational area here would be constructed in that time frame, except for the recreational area to the rear, which would be coincide with when that is developed.
If I could comment on it, Preston Shell with Ocean Atlantic. You know, that's sometimes doing a disservice to your initial homeowners, because we have some communities that are 2 years old that have three homeowners, and three homeowners don't want to pay the HOA fees associated with maintaining an amenity structure of that size. So it's difficult. I have to kind of predict market conditions in order to estimate when it makes sense to build the amenities. And in a perfect world where the amenities service themselves for free, we probably could build them up front. But you really straddle your HOA with, you know, your HOA begs you not to build them if you have nine homes sold and you're about to start a $3.5 million amenity facility that has a carrying cost of $300,000 to $350,000 a year. So it really should be predicated upon when you get a CO on, say, your 50th or 75th home. And if that happens to be within 3 months, we'll start in 3 months. If it happens to be in 3 years, it's really appropriate to start that amenity in 3 years. So it would probably be preferred if the timeline wasn't a fixed timeline. It was when you have 50 homeowners or some predetermined amount actually living at your site, that's the appropriate time to start an amenity of that size.
And I think the commission's well aware that this is a question that's come up recently. Back 5-6 years ago, build it right up front, because if you build it there, it will come, but those days are over.
What would that number be?
For a project this 256 homes, I would say to build the amenity out there, it's really when the infrastructure gets there. That's really just be, say, when you, as soon as you get that road past that location, you got to put that amenity in. Because obviously those will be the last lots we get to, because the infrastructure naturally comes from Route 16 towards the Broadkill River, and our most valuable lots, which we prefer to sell in the end, happen to be right along there. So even though we may have a path and a trail system, and I'd say that should be by at least the 100th home, I would say this section right here should be started when you get the CO on the 50th home, the major amenity right there. And that doesn't mean that it's going to pay for itself. The developer will probably carry a large portion of that until you hit about the 150th home. And sometimes we do that. Our Independence community, we started our amenity, a 455-unit community, we started it at, gosh, we'd only sold maybe 20 homes or so. But active adult residents generally will not move into a community until their amenity's done. This, we don't intend for this to be age-restricted.
It's because they don't want to die before you get it finished.
What type of housing are you predicting?
This we've considered a lot of different styles. This is, we're leaning towards possibly utilizing our zero-energy home builder, which is a highly energy efficient home. It's actually built out of concrete most of the time, structurally insulated panels and kind of poured in place concrete. And it has solar panels, sometimes wind systems, low-E windows. In general, you'd save about 30% to 50% of your electric cost relative to what it would be if it was just a standard home. But the only reason we didn't turn this whole project into a green project, it's in level four. And, you know, in meeting with the state, they felt like that somewhat contradicted the intent of kind of where they're heading with their green program. But that doesn't mean that we can't build highly energy efficient homes.
That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Fuqua, I'd like to commend you all, too, on your presentation booklet by superimposing your comments on plus comments. It makes it a whole lot easier. As you well know, I, for one, rely upon that heavily in terms of my review of projects. And the fact that you responded positively to some of their comments, I have no further questions.
We are trying to get the word around.
Mr. Gordy.
I have no questions.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up with something that Mr. Schell touched on, have you been able to prepare a type of budget that the HOA, they would know what it would cost to manage their open space areas and stormwater facilities?
Yeah, we used to learn that lesson the hard way, where we just let the expenses come in and that was the budget. Now, every single time one of our site planners or engineers makes a change on the site, it's got to be updated in the HOA budget so we don't get carried away and build something that necessitates a $400 a month HOA fee because you can never sell a home. And no one would really want to live there. So we do that. And a lot of our recreation, you know, unlike Painter's Mill, if you go in Painter's Mill, it looks great. It's really, really pricey to keep something that looks like that with that much manicured open space and that much every single blade of grass in that development outside someone's home is irrigated on all 102 acres. And it looks great, but it costs a fortune. So a lot of our open space here will actually be kind of passive, natural open space, the reforested area, or afforested area, as they like to say, and some of the other areas up against the fox squirrel. The known habitat at this time for fox squirrel happens to be down here, which is also one of the reasons why we have the biggest buffer on the site happens to be right here. So this area, this will not be irrigated, perfectly cut grass fields. We'll probably go in and do some form of planting in here, but the idea is to let it go into some form of natural state that doesn't look unkept and disheveled, but it'll probably just start to merge with the forest next door over time, and that would probably be the intended use. The areas that we've labeled afforestation is when we actually go in there with a plan that's approved by the state forestry's office, and you plant all these different species, and if the trees die, you got to come back and plant them again. But we will likely reforestate other areas. We just probably won't do it with a detailed, you know, state forester plan.
Well, thank you. So the answer was yes, you would prepare a budget.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yeah. We've learned.
Thank you. If this moves forward, I believe, and I think Mr. Fuqua would remember me asking a question prompted by Mr. Lank, would your field people be resistant to fixing the silt fence or the super silt fence at the buffer line of the wetland, you know, at groundbreaking? I think Mr. Lank had reminded us in some cases that the buffer line had been disturbed and then it had been reaffixed, you know, post-construction.
No, we would not be adverse to that. We would definitely do that if it was ever damaged or disturbed.
Put the silt fence or the super silt fence at the buffer line around the wetland or areas.
Yep, we will definitely do that.
Thank you.
If you guys want to hear about it, we have a new product that we're using.
Instead of silt fence, we've actually gotten approved with Denrec to use, it's called a Filtrex. It's a compost-filled sock.
To who?
It's a compost-filled sock that does exactly the same thing as silt fence. However, it's much more environmentally friendly. In fact, when it's all said and done and you're done with your silt fence, instead of picking up your stakes and rolling up all of your snow fence stuff, you actually just slip the sock open, and it's all biodegradable. It becomes basically fertilizer and composting for the for that area. Mm-hmm. So we've worked exclusively with a couple different companies and with Denrec to get that approved as an approved alternative to silt fence.
And the greatest thing is you can run over it with a tractor and it just bounces right back up.
Yeah, it's so. A 6-to-1 compression ratio. So you literally can bounce up and down it all day long and walk away and it just fills right back up.
Yeah, gentlemen, you need to know that this group may not be that impressed by that for the simple fact that the whole reason for the silt fence, asking the silt fence to be located at the buffer line, is because a man on a bulldozer works to the silt fence. Okay, the fact that he can run over it easily doesn't quite fit in with what we had in mind, but I understand, being in the business myself, I know what you're talking about.
It's pretty tall, too.
It's a barrier. Right. Yeah, it's a barrier. The point is, if the barrier is at the inside edge of the buffer instead of the outside,
right,
the property line, then they won't be disturbing the buffer, because we've had several instances in developments where the silt fence goes up, the bulldozer comes in, and...
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying don't place it on the other side of the 30 or 50 yeah. to 200
feet.
Put
the buffer behind the silt fence.
That never made sense to me anyway.
Yeah, the guys will stay on the right side of the silt fence and won't get into the buffer.
We're happy to have that as
that's
a stipulation.
Good practice anyway.
Certainly, certainly the new material sounds interesting. And like you said,
we can use the old material. It's cheaper.
That's
matter. Just, it's not cheaper to fix.
I don't think that's up to us. Somebody else will tell you what to use, I'm sure. Anything else, Mr. Smith?
Nope.
Okay, Mr. Lank?
No questions.
All right. Mr. Abbott?
No questions.
Counsel?
No questions.
All right, then. Gentlemen, we thank you for your presentation. Please take a seat nearby. We'll see if there's anybody here with an interest in your application. Is there anyone here that would like to speak in favor of subdivision 2007-9 Thompson Shell LLC? Is there anyone here that would like to speak in opposition to subdivision 2007-9? Yes, sir. Please come on up, give us your name, and you may have the floor.
I'm Doug Lodge. I live in Broad Kill, which is right up the road from on 16. After listening to the presentation, it is rather an impressive design for a cluster community. I think they've thought of a great number of things, and they've been implemented properly. My only concern is that it isn't a level 4, and they even touched upon that also, that it's not in line with what the state has ultimately planned for developments in the state. Now, I'm, of course, not here to debate whether that's right or wrong or unfair, but that's my only concern, is that it's not actually in the right area. I think a lot of thought has gone into it, and, you know, it butts up to an ag preservation site. Right across the street is the National Wildlife Refuge. I think it's safe to say that it doesn't fit in the neighborhood. If your neighborhood's ag and wildlife refuge, it will stick out like a sore thumb no matter how much planning and site goes into it. And I also note, by traveling on 16 every day, that regardless of a DLDOT study or a TIS study done by any engineering firm, the intersection is a dangerous intersection. It's busy. For some reason, people can't see the light when they're on Route 1, and they constantly going through it. And it's a busy intersection. So I believe 600 and some people would add to the congestion of an intersection there, and that's undeniable. So, but once again, I'm not here to cause trouble. I just think that a lot of thought went into it, and I applaud that effort, but I just don't think it's the right place to do it.
All right, sir, we thank you. We'll take your comments under advisement. If anyone else would like to speak in opposition, anyone on the commission have any questions?
Question?
Yes, sir, Mr. Lang.
Was this a West Farm?
Yes.
Isn't that an ag preservation district?
No.
At one time?
Yeah, it was at one time.
It wasn't one time. There's a letter in the exhibit book.
It's not. It never was an easement. It was only a district. 10-year permit.
It was submitted and never, the land was never entered into.
So is the adjoining property an ag preservation at all?
No, that came out at the same time.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. That's all.
Thank you, sir. Okay, there being no more questions, we'll close the public hearing. We'll invite you to remain with us for the rest of your Thursday evening to see if we make a decision, or you may wish to call the office in the morning.